Four. Mr. James, we're talking about Algiers, and could you talk a little bit about your impressions of Algiers and of
Yes, we had 3 days to spare in Algiers, having landed, and we from there eucalyptus, we should go in to see the sights. And of course, there's a Kasbah in Algiers, and one is not supposed to go into the Kasbah, you know, because it's one of those places where you have to disappear. And even soldiers, were told, do not go in the Kasbah. And the Kasbah was guarded by police as well, red caps for the British and white snowdrop for the Americans, and they were in large numbers, keeping everybody away from the Kasbah. But of course, soldiers, we'd heard so much about it that we would like to explore, but we couldn't explore the Kasbah. But we certainly explored the rest of Algiers in a big way. And those who hadn't yet gone up to the line, those who were newly arrived in Algiers, waiting for their time to go up the line, made the most of their 3 days in Algiers and saw the sights and learned the ropes as well. One of the things that I do remember vividly, of course, and because of the large queues that were evident, there were three places for exhibitions and bordellos, shall we call them. And they were very opulent, the whole three of them. One was called the Black Cat, the other one was called the Number 22, the other one was called the Half Moon. And most of the battalion and every other regiment in Algiers, they were queuing up 40, but I've seen queues in the 30 years, of course, in a while, or a mile long. Waiting to go in, you had to pay to go in to see the exhibitions, and that was what I wanted more than anything else. To go and to see the exhibitions, you had to go inside these opulent places, past a great big fat Maltese who had his sort of funny hat on, and you paid, and they had big red, hundreds of red plush seats. And chandeliers everywhere, and mirrors and chrome, they were palaces. And if you wanted to sit in the plush chair and seats, the available ladies walking about in circles in front of you. If anybody finds you one of those, they'd sort of leave their seat and go down and tap her on the shoulder, and she'd take them away. But then, that's if you wanted to sort of have a look at the what was going on. But to go to the exhibitions, one had to ascend stairs, and there were queues for that as well.
And were these queues all British, American,
all mixed up? A big mixture of British and American, especially the Americans.
And was there, were any of these places out of bounds to other ranks?
No, they were all in bounds.
And so would you have officers mixed up in this?
All in bounds. And there were brevet officers there, brigadiers, and senior naval officers. And seeing these people, it was condoned. It's not broadcast and nobody talks about it, but it was condoned, obviously, by the War Department.
And was there any kind of embarrassing moments where somebody might see the commanding officer or commanding officer?
No, I never saw that, but I certainly saw them. I went into the CN exhibition and he went to George Gates. And we were sitting.
You had a story about George Gates, didn't you?
That's right. Yeah. Old George, he was a bit of a character and he was a real cockney. He was immaculately turned out as a warrant officer, but he wasn't tall. He bottled when he bought, believe it or not. He had very good teeth, although they were protruding a little bit. And his face was obvious as if he'd just had about 10 pints of beer. You know what I mean? That was the colour of his face. It was a fresh ruddiness. And he'd say, come on, give me a drink of blood bath. Let's have a look at our bloodbath today. We could be going to the exhibitions, but it was a quite an experience, actually. It was like a theatre. It was live theatre. And it really was. You wouldn't see it anywhere else in the world, really. But mainly, I mean, the exhibitions were done by lesbians. But anyway...
Were any of the men... I mean, you talked earlier about Sergeant Deegan, who obviously didn't go away with you abroad, or, you know, with the 16th...
Sergeant, but before
yes, the but were there any of the men who were, like, shocked by this, that were just, like, literally... Did you ever get a men that you saw that wouldn't go, that were shocked by the whole...
Oh,
the
my God, yes, a lot of them did. Oh, my God, yes. A lot of them were happily married, especially the married men. They wouldn't think of it. They were newly out of England. They had just said goodbye to their loved ones, you know. But on arriving in Algiers, for the unmarried, for the footloose and fancy free, and soldiers are soldiers and sailors are sailors. Mm.
So there was a sense that these men were thinking, well, we're going to go into danger, we might as well enjoy ourselves while we can. Was it that sense?
Well, the attitude was, obviously, it conveyed to us as well that we were informed. We were informed officially that these places were inbounds, there were military police at the entrances to keep order and arrest any miscreants, or there was orderliness, and that the ladies were inspected several times a day by service doctors, and they were passed. And that these places were in bounds. Now, we knew the out-of-bounds sign very well, and the off-limits, as the Americans would say, and there were many, many places off-limits, and the Cantabon was one. But it was condoned. We were going up to the line in 2 or 3 days, we were told. We'd have field route marches, we'd have some inspections, and we could expect to be on our way to the front line in a matter of 2 or 3 days. And we were to make the most of the senior sites in our chairs, because we wouldn't be seeing it, you know, we'd be out, we'd be going. And when we were there, we'd be about 400 miles east of Algiers to where the battlefield was. It's 400 miles, a hell of a long way to the railhead.
I should have asked you, you said you were told, were the lectures on the ship that would warn you of the sights and you know, the experiences of Algiers, were there any lectures of that kind?
No, but everybody was aware of Algiers and its notoriety. There were several sort of cheap sixpenny novels about the white slave traffic, and these were passed and well dogged from person to person, you know, and it was in those days, even pre-war, the British newspapers, you know, used to write about missing girls from Liverpool and turning up in Algiers, and there were most of these prostitutes, incidentally, were captured slaves from Europe, and they dared to escape. They all had on their bellies operation marks on their and all of their ovaries. And they were girls who were shanghaied into prostitution in Algiers by Maltese and people like that, and they just couldn't escape. They were prisoners. They dared to escape, they'd get stabbed or murdered or something.
At this stage, you would have encountered American troops for the first time in large numbers. What was your impression
of
the Americans?
Well, that's right, and everywhere in Algiers, everywhere were American stations called prophylactic stations, where the Americans would go for ointment before and after, to put it simply. Medical people there looking after the Americans, the prophylactic stations there, they called them, and I remember that particularly.
What was your impression of the Americans?
Well, I mean to say they were overpaid. I mean, the American private had more money than an English captain. I mean, I know this is all going down in the records, but it is so, and everybody knew that they were wealthy, they were well off, they were well clothed, well fed, and well looked after as well. And they had tons of money.
Did you ever encounter any of them when you were in Algiers, in terms of when you remember any?
Not in Algiers, because we they were news, you know. I mean, we had seen them in England there, from over in the war sort of thing. But we put it, like, we were anti-American really, because I must say this, because we were jealous of their money, we were jealous of they were getting all the birds, and you know, and we couldn't compete with them. We had their money.
Were you jealous of their uniforms?
And we had different personalities as well.
Were you jealous of their uniforms?
Absolutely. We were jealous of everything, especially their money. They had everything. And not only that, they didn't have a packet of fags. They had several 200 boxes. It's amazing. Camels and Chesterfields. Once or twice, we were offered a packet of fags. We took them. Not one fag. Get off your pack. Lovely, and the camels tasted toasted, you know, they were lovely.
apart from that kind of houses of ill repute, what was the rest of, what did Algiers offer in terms of, you know, places to drink and places to eat, and
there were French speaking, very few of us spoke French, some of us had soldiers French. The population were quite receptive to us, and they were Espagnoles, and I think that the drink that I can remember very well was the Muscatel type of wine, you know. That's all you could drink, really. It was what was available. The beer was like tea. You couldn't drink the beer. It was terrible, but we went for the wines, you know, and they weren't really wines, they were sort of cheap grape concoctions, you know, muscatel and probably what they were called. But there was a smell about Algiers, the smell of the Orient. There's every woman passed by had perfume, you know. There was this, some of the smells were noxious, but generally speaking, it had a peculiarity, it had an individuality, Algiers. It was something that had to be experienced, you know, all these Arab women walking over the Ashnaks, you just saw all these black eyes, and they wouldn't look at you, you know, and they'd be walking in groups, and these long flowing robes, and the Arabs themselves are filthy, you know. And tangerines, everybody trying to sell you oranges and tangerines, and things like that, and fly swats. The pies were terrible.
What was your impression of the Arab population and compared to the French population? And did you?
Oh, we realised the French had kept them down. They were subjugated, the French were brutal. And within their colonies, they were the boss. And I get a sense, you know, that France was the this was the colony of France. It was sort of we were thrilled with Algiers as well because it was a foreign region connected. You know, City Belapis is a foreign region, so in their quarters, but it was a foreign region, yes. And we saw a lot of them as well, funnily enough.
And what did you think of that?
And later on, they fought at the sight of us. You know, French foreign region. Oh yes, immediately before the battle.
We'll get on to that. In terms of the routine of actually getting back to Algiers, how would that work? You're at Maison Carree. How would they organise?
Because we had so little time, and we knew that we'd only be there for 2 or 3 days, we had a truck usually laid on to take those who wanted to see the sights, a truck for company. later on a 30 hundredweight. And you could sort of jump in, and that would hold a lot of men standing. You'd be standing up all the way, hanging on to the third to the canopy, you know. And so there was a sort of a liberty jump in.
And how many men would be on the truck?
And when would it
leave?
Well, then you tell you, you know, right, you are, we are leaving from this point at 5:30 or 5 p.m. or something like that, you know, from Ealing Mill. And we'd be there. And if you missed the truck, you had a bloody walk, and nobody wanted to walk 18 miles. It was about 18 miles. I'm not kidding, it might have been more. It seemed to me, some records say 15, but it was at least 18 miles to the eucalyptus. We used to say, yes, you didn't understand in those days, you know.
And what time, how long would you have in Algiers?
I mean, by the time you were sort of left early in the morning after breakfast, and you'd had enough really, and lots of chats were kind of a knee jump with this ship and the other. And by the time the truck was due, you know, you were ready to go back. But there was no roll call, and then you weren't there.
And what time was the truck to take you back?
Well, as I say, that was roughly about 5 minutes or 6 ish.
And what was the ride back like
it was not a line, you know. We remember the bloody walk.
In terms of the, obviously, you'd have a bunch of young, innocent men who'd never been abroad before, and then 10 hours later, they're getting on this truck. I mean, can you remember any kind of incidents?
That's right. I mean, it's a, everybody, some of them, couldn't leave the place alone. Some of them were so delighted with it, you know, that really speaking, it was such a fascinating, different, foreign, attractive place. The soldiers, anyway.
Had you ever been abroad before?
No, I never was a soldier. No, not at all.
And
I've never been abroad before.
And how many of...
That was my first soldier.
And how many of D Company do you think had been abroad before?
None of us. None of us had been abroad before the war. You know, nobody had a time off. Nobody had holidays with pay.
Can you remember anything about the officers and what they were doing? I mean, was the impression that they were...
Well, they kept themselves to themselves, but I think that they were having they were enjoying themselves. They were human after all, and I think that they probably had their share of fun and the ladies as well, but it wasn't very evident.
So how many...
Except, of course, as I said to you, the unknown officers from all arms of all the services within these places did look at the exhibitions, British and American, seen the ranks as well.
So what was the highest rank that you spotted?
Well, I remember particularly this when David did a brigadier, he became victim of one of these lesbians because she sorted him out and stood in front of him and did something. And we all laughed and were like, because it was him.
So when you were coming back from Algiers on the truck, I mean, would there be like a sing song?
We'd typical soldiers, we'd be there'd be banter, there'd be people saying, "Did you see what I saw today?" and all that sort of thing. And there was a lot of local who was something nameless, but he told us that the woman that he was with wanted him to stay with her all the time.
Now, apart from, how many times did you manage to get back to Algiers? I mean, how many times did the troops?
At least daily. 3 days, shall we say. I don't think it's not longer than that. It was about 3 or 4 days, as far as I can remember. We arrived in Algiers about the 3rd of January. It was about 10 days on the boat. And we're bloody glad we got off. And I think we were lucky as well to get through, because we did in the half of it. they worshipped Sank, and it was an active warfare. And I was glad to get off the campaign, away from the sea, in Stonewall.
So what? Yeah, sorry.
And when we saw Algiers from the sea, oh, I'm forgetting the sight, you know. Really, a wonderful sight. And it got nearer and nearer and nearer. And the biggest disappointment was when we got onto the quayside and we were told that we had this march. And all the kit bags were going on this truck, on and they were going to march. And we were told about 10 miles, but it was really, nobody knew. Nobody knew. The chap was at 10 miles. I had no idea where the eucalyptus was.
Now, when you were at eucalyptus at Maison Carree, what was your routine as quartermaster sergeant?
First of all, we had there was a little bit of training and PT in marching, small marches, and checks, pit checks, and to make sure that you were going into battle, and we had to make sure that every man was fully equipped, and you know, and had everything. I remember that particular.
How would that work? Talk us through that.
It was very simple. I mean, the companies were sorted out, and they were all allotted their particular path. We were in this big French farm, and I didn't know what the arrangement was, but obviously they were French farmers who would be approached by the army, and they were probably pro your allies, and they were very willing. But they had their own little army themselves, about centuries and whatnot, with old-fashioned long First World War rifles. And they got on them as well. But they let us alone, and they told us where we could sleep. And we were in this bat for 3 days. I slept on top of my bat, actually.
But in terms of the kit inspection, how would that work? Would you assemble the entire kit?
It was not a very thorough thing. It wasn't sort of a laid-out kit inspection. And it was as far as I can remember, we spoke to every man and we ensured that he wasn't short of any gathering, because he would be sorry if he was.
Did you? I should have asked earlier, but did you have a kit inspection on the boat before you disembarked?
No, there was no room. There was chaos on the boat. I mean, the other ranks were down in the bay. I went down to see where they were, as the CVMS, to see what their accommodation was like. And I don't know, like, it was all very hanging hammocks. And they weren't even put away. I mean, there was kit everywhere. And you couldn't maintain discipline either, because the boat was quite a large boat, and if you wanted to find a man, you'd be shouting at wages before you'd find him, you know, because it could be in the top deck, it could have been anywhere. And so that if you had something to tell them, you'd say, 2 o'clock, a meeting. Be on your deck at 2 o'clock, and Major Captain Bailey and Sergeant Major, or the secret to be there, for this purpose, that purpose, the other purpose. So that you had control of them. But once you'd lost control of them, you had a hell of a job to find somebody.
The battalion history talks of lectures on the preparation for battle taking place at this stage. Can you remember anything about that?
Messages in preparation for battle?
Lectures.
Lectures in preparation for battle. Well, some of the officers did give their platoon lectures, but I didn't sit in on those. And two sergeants as well. I had to give one lecture on emergency cooking for oneself.
And that was with the Tommy Cooker, which you were talking about.
That's right, and I gave an invitation there as well with the Tommy Cooker. It was something new to me as well, but I had tried that out.
And had you moved over to the compo rations by this stage?
Oh, no. The compo rations came when we were in the front line. We didn't have any bread for 6 long months. No bread. Now, I love bread. We get a couple of rations for boxed food.
Oh, well, we'll get to that when you get to that. So how were the men being fed at this stage? And how were you involved?
Well, I'm trying to think, actually. That's one little lapse in my memory about the way we messed about it. There weren't very many of us in the club. But there was one I really can't remember, unless the cooks, they always had their 1300-weight truck. Companies had their 1300-weight truck with all the gear on there. The basic gear was burners, paraffin burners, and these great big containers in vacuum boxes. And it was very, very simple to get out of the truck and get your burners going and make porridge for the company or stew. But of course, where the hell is the quartermaster going to get his lessons from? We might well have had, I don't know. I really don't know the source.
So you can't remember,
cannot remember that.
Doing much paperwork and so on at this stage in terms
No, the paperwork is minimal because you just return to another question. It was all physical stuff, doing stuff. What I do remember is that we all had these flat tins that keep children and brother in there. And I remember particularly we used them well on the way on our train journey by getting, when the train stopped, the train didn't go very fast. And it was quite slow. I hope we never get there. It took 2 or 3 days. But when the train stopped, the ones who felt like it had his mess tin ready, his empty mess tin ready, to run along to the engine and say to the engine driver, let off some steam. And he'd let off steam, and he'd have a boiling water in your mess tin, and you'd go back carefully with it. And you'd get your tin of sugar milk powder, a teaspoon of milk, and you'd make yourself a smash cup of tea. And it tastes very good. Tea powder, amazing.
Are there any other memories of Mason Curry before we move forward to Gardimau? Anything else that sticks in your mind?
No, I can only remember particularly entraining at Mason Curry. That was where the train was, this enormous train. And I was sitting in a French coach, but there were trucks on it as well.
Trucks as in cattle trucks.
H. Chibble, 32 ohms. Putting in soldiers' parlance. 8 horses and 32 men. And they were all marked as such as well.
So you were lucky enough to get a seat.
I had a seat. I was sitting in the carriage. I was an NCO. I was privileged. But it's a general. It's a hell of a long train, and some of them had the trucks.
Can you remember?
Horse trucks.
Can you remember who was in the carriage with you?
No, I can't. Well, yes, I can remember RQMS, politely. But he was one of them with me. And I remember as well that in the adjoining carriages there were NCOs, because suddenly, the attitude, I mean, I was a senior rank myself, but I was a secret, I was an admin, but the attitude of the senior ranks, the sergeant majors as well, got very, very snotty, and discipline was imposed, and they began to boss about unsmilingly, you know. And I could sense that the easy time to finish, and again, we are going into the run line, and this is going to be on the utmost necessity. You have to obey orders.